This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Michael Monks.
Booker T. Washington said that there's two ways to exert power. You can push down or you can pull up. These three city council members, including Mr. Sittenfeld, have been pushing down on honest services. They've been pushing down on the people of Cincinnati and standing on their backs and lining their pockets. Instead of pulling Cincinnati up and making them a top 25 city in the United States to live.
That's the voice of Chris Hoffman, special agent in charge for the FBI here in Cincinnati, speaking just an hour ago at a news conference in which an indictment against Cincinnati City Councilman P.G. Sittenfeld was explained. The 36-year-old councilman and mayoral candidate was arrested in his home just today. According to the federal indictment now available to us, Sittenfeld allegedly solicited money from a developer in exchange for a plan to develop the former Convention Place Mall at 435 Elm Street. That involves Cincinnati developer Chinatown Indukwe. You may remember him as a former Bengals player, also caught up in the federal bribery charges against Cincinnati City Councilman Jeff Pastor. That's two members of City Council arrested in just the past several weeks, the third arrested just this year, all on federal bribery charges. We should note that Sittenfeld is accused of bribery, wire fraud, and attempted extortion. It all involves tens of thousands of dollars that were allegedly funneled to his political action committee. He had created, according to the Inquirer, a more than $700,000 campaign war chest in his effort to be elected the next mayor. He is serving his second term on city council right now, first elected in 2011. Let's hear more from this morning's press conference. You're going to hear from David DeVillers. He is the United States Attorney for the Southern District of Ohio.
We don't have to prove, by the way, an expressed quid pro quo. And we're alleging that there's a quid pro quo in this case. Don't get me wrong. But what we have to prove is even an implicit agreement. And what you have is you've got to look at a lot of different things. Once you get that statement, right, in of itself, that may or may not be enough. But then you got to look at, all right, what else is going on here? Are they trying to hide the proceeds of how this money's coming in? Are they ripping off the citizens of Cincinnati by exclusively trying to do, or anywhere else, hypothetically, something for one person as opposed to other people, other citizens? Are they actually physically getting this money themselves in a check to put in their accounts? Are they hiding? Is it a slush fund, or is it going directly into a campaign? So you look at all these circumstances surrounding these events to let you know what's going to happen.
According to reporting by Dan Horn and Sherry Coolidge at the Cincinnati Inquirer, Sittenfeld had conversations with undercover agents and promised that his popularity among voters and his clout at City Hall would deliver these agents who were posing as investors what they wanted. He said, quote, "Don't let these be my famous last words, but I can always get a vote to my left or a vote to my right." This was back in December of 2018. Let's talk about it now with WVXU senior political analyst Howard Wilkinson. Howard, thank you for being with us.
Thank you, Michael.
So you had just written a column not that many days ago. What was it? Yesterday this was published? Why the culture of corruption at Cincinnati City Hall? And that was after we knew of two arrests. And now there are three arrests this year among the Cincinnati City Council. Your thoughts of what the news that broke today?
Well, number one, that column is still up on our website, and it's been updated to reflect what happened today. I mean, this is extraordinary. Now, the Sittenfeld case is different from Denard and Pastor in that there's no allegation that he was putting this money into his own pocket. But this was possibly even worse. He was pressuring developers to give money to a secret PAC that he was planning on using to as a basis for his run for mayor in 2021, and promising that he could deliver votes or he could kill their projects. He could make those projects happen, or he could make those projects not happen. And the allegation is that he made direct threats to these, what turned out to be undercover agents, who ended up delivering him these 10 checks in 2018, 2019, to total $40,000. And each one of those checks was written from a different LLC so that they would be hard to trace. and they were placed into this secret political action committee.
P.G. Sittenfeld is someone who, if you were an outside observer looking in, you would think that he had a relatively bright political future. He's young. He's 36 years old. He's a candidate for mayor. He served a couple of terms now on the city council. He had an unsuccessful Democratic primary for the U.S. Senate in Ohio. But this has to be surprising to all of these people who have supported him over the years, expecting him to have a long future in government service.
Well, absolutely. I mean, look at the last two. He was the youngest person ever elected to council in 2011. And he's been the top vote getter in council election twice now. He was by far, it seemed at least, the leading candidate for mayor to replace John Cranley, who can't run again next year. And now it would seem that all of that is disappearing, and disappearing very quickly.
We should note that Councilman Mann is also running for mayor. A couple of other outside challengers have filed. This should make that an open race at this point. If we expect these criminal charges to proceed, of course, these are allegations. These are indictments,
yes.
But everyone's innocent until proven guilty. We have not heard from Councilman Sittenfeld yet. I'll tell you who we have heard from. That's Councilman Chris Seelbach. He tweeted just this morning, quote, "Incredibly surreal to be typing these words, but again, I have never been offered, asked for, or accepted a bribe in my life." Howard, I imagine that members of council, just as members of the public, have got to be wondering what's next.
Yeah, they are wondering what's next. They are wondering if, number one, if other council members are being investigated by the FBI. I mean, this is a wide-ranging investigation that's not just happening here, but it's happening in Columbus as well. Two different teams of FBI agents that are doing nothing but trying to root out public corruption.
We heard United States Attorney David DeVille say this morning about this case with the arrest of Jeff Pastor and P.G. Sittenfeld, both members of Cincinnati City Council, that while they were, I suppose, talking to the same agents, they were not being investigated for cooperating together on any type of schemes. They were both working on their own alleged illegalities, independent of one another, on the same development.
That's absolutely the case. I mean, they were, as DeVille said, drinking from the same cup, but they weren't working together. You know, as I said, the Sittenfeld charges involve basically extorting money for this political action committee. And in Pastor's case, it was basically money that was going to go into his pocket.
Well, let me ask you, what do you think happens on the campaign trail? I know we just ended a brutal election season for a lot of races nationally and, of course, here in our local region. But in the odd number of years is when we look at Cincinnati city government. And there's a mayoral race next year. We were just talking about P.G. Sittenfeld being likely a leading candidate. He certainly had a ton of money. Longtime local government official, councilman, former Congressman David Mann is also a candidate for mayor. What do you think the message is going to be for candidates, not just for the top job at City Hall, but for council now, which is going to have many open seats?
Well, it was going to have many open seats anyway. I mean, there were just, you know, a lot of people.
And you've been listening to Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVX. The producer of today's show is Selena Reeder. The technical director is Josh Astro. Our theme music is composed by Rob Fetters. You can find archives of our program online at WVXU.org. I'm Michael Marks.
For the time being, while the charges are pending against him, Sittenfeld, we don't know. There probably will be some sort of effort to do the same with him, to suspend him from city council. It's hard to imagine him resigning, but people are calling for that. David Mann called for that this morning, and so have many others.
Let's take a quick phone call. We have Bernadine on the line. Hi, Bernadine. What's your question or comment?
Hi, you guys. Thanks so much for having this program on. It's so important. Howard, you know so much about Cincinnati political history. I'm wondering if, didn't we have something like this, a kind of a real big scandal in the council, and that led to the rise of the Charterite Party? When I first started voting eons ago, the Charterite Party was in power, and I think they did really well. What can you talk about that?
Bernadine, thank you for the call. I'll hang up and let Howard offer that answer. So Bernadine's asking about, I guess, what led to the creation of the Charterite Party. Cincinnati at one point, I think this was 100 years ago, was the standard bearer for government reform.
It was back in the 1920s. For many decades before that, there was a Republican political machine which was not only corrupt, but incompetent. And there were a number of progressive lawyers, Republicans, Democrats, independents, got together and decided to put together a charter form of government, a council manager form of government, which reduced the size of government from city council from 26 members to 9 members. And the council manager form of government was supposed to, and has for most of its life, kept this kind of thing out of the purview of city council members. The city administration dealt with developers, not individual council members. And that's where the systemic problem is, because when this did not become a problem until individual council members started trying to negotiate deals with private developers. And that is not supposed to happen under our form of government. And it did, and it has led to some very serious ethical problems.
WVXU senior political analyst Howard Wilkinson. You can read his columns at WVXU.org, including his very recently updated column, Analysis, Why the Culture of Corruption at Cincinnati City Hall. Howard, thanks for taking some time with us today.
Thank you, Michael.
And now for our regularly scheduled program, we are joined by the political junkie, Ken Rudin. Ken, welcome back.
Thank you, Michael.
We also have University of Oklahoma Assistant Professor of Political Science at the Carl Albert Congressional Research and Studies Center, Dr. Rachel Bloom. Rachel, thank you for being back.
Thanks for having me.
We're going to be talking national politics mostly now. Give us a call at 513-419-7100. You can also tweet at us at 917-WVXU or email talk at WVXU.org. As always, when we have the political junkie on the program, he brings along a trivia question for you to answer and win a big, big prize. Ken, what is this month's question?
The prize, of course, is a political junkie button. The question is, assuming we have all the results in hand from the November 3rd election, no member of Congress from either Ohio or Kentucky lost in the election. The question is, who is the last member of the House from either state to lose to a challenger in the general election in November?
Okay, so we're talking about the last incumbent member of Congress, the House,
from Ohio or Kentucky.
From Ohio or Kentucky to lose to a challenger in November. If you know the answer, it's the same number, 513-419-7100. If you are correct, you will win one of those coveted political junkie buttons. Well, we always talk about national politics when we have you all on, Ken and Dr. Bloom, but let's start with what you all also heard Howard and I speaking of, the arrest of a third member of City Council, the second in just a span of weeks. With this going on here locally and similar cases playing out across the country naturally, as it does, the ongoing dispute from the president who lost the election earlier this month, claiming to have won the election, and the national government's tepid response to the COVID-19 pandemic that has now claimed 250,000 American lives. Ken, how do you rate Americans' view of government? What could our trust level possibly be at this point?
You know, as I was listening to Howard's report, I was thinking that exact same thing. I mean, the fact is that what the Trump administration is trying to do now is doing everything they can to forestall the certification of votes in Michigan and Georgia and states like that around the country, and by doing that in Arizona, and by doing those, so perhaps as we come to the December 14th deadline for the Electoral College, there's some talk about maybe the Republican state legislatures in some states, especially Pennsylvania, offering its own slate of electors to go to the Electoral College, which of course would favor Trump, even though Joe Biden won the state of the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania. My point is that all these threats to democracy, all these threats to the system of voting, have really scared and upset a lot of people who believe that really these democratic institutions are being threatened from within, not even from without. We used to talk about Russian intervention. Now it's from within, and that's even more frightening than anything else.
Dr. Bloom, same question for you in the context of us watching a president, a sitting president, in an unprecedented manner, talking about an election that has taken place, but having been rigged against him, while also having members of our government not being on the same page about how we're supposed to respond to this COVID-19 pandemic. What are Americans supposed to view about the government right now?
Well, I think it's hard to say. If we can put this in a little bit of historical context, the Pew Research Center released a report in September of this year, kind of giving trends on trust in government. And they show that for the last 10 years, trust in government has been at historic lows. So 15 to 20% of Americans think the government is doing the right thing almost always or most of the time, which is really low. And of course, this relates to the federal government, but we can assume that people have low trust in other institutions as well, especially right now. The other complicating factor is that since Trump's presidency, Republicans have shifted on this a little bit. So Republicans trust government more right now than they did when Obama was president. And of course, that does flip in a partisan way. So some of what we might be seeing right now is just the partisan in-party, out-party flip on how much people trust government. But there's also an extent to which this is a little bit of a different circumstance than people before. This isn't just how does the government handle disasters or how does the government handle immigration. It's will a sitting president who seems by every margin we normally look at to have lost an election, will that president concede? And when that president is very popular with one party and has quite a following that see his views and statements as the truth and everything else is fake, it's hard to have a conversation where everyone in the country is operating from the same starting point. So whether or not we see some sort of procedural implication of this, I think there's a substantive issue that we need to think about with democracy right now, which is whether we're able to have democratic discourse as citizens, as governments.
513-419-7100 is the number to call if you'd like to join our conversation with the political junkie Ken Rudin or the University of Oklahoma Assistant Professor of Political Science, Dr. Rachel Bloom. Ken, the president is still to this day, weeks after the election, and calling it rigged against him, suggesting that there's voter fraud. All of his tweets lately have been flagged by Twitter as being disputed or being hidden from view, really. You have to activate to be able to see the tweet. I'm reading in the Washington Post right now a story that came out less than an hour ago that President Trump called a Republican canvassing board member in Wayne County. That's in Detroit, or Detroit is in Wayne County, I should say. That's in Michigan. And this canvassing board member is reported to have announced just yesterday that she wanted to rescind her decision to certify the results of the presidential election. But the president has called a Republican canvassing board member in a county in Michigan. Can you put into context for us how unprecedented this president's behavior is in relation to this treasured institution of democracy, voting?
Well, it's one thing. First of all, as Dr. Bloom mentioned, he has not conceded yet, and he doesn't have to concede. That's just a formality. There's no legal basis to a concession. Remember, Al Gore conceded in November of 2000, then he unconceded, and then he conceded again in December when it was decided. But that doesn't matter. What really matters, of course, is the electors deciding on December 14th of who the president is. But what he has done by calling this member of there were two Republican and two Democratic members of the canvass board, and the two Republicans initially said they wouldn't certify the results, which is unbelievable because they said there were maybe 300 or 400 suspicious votes in the Wayne County or somewhere like that, and that was amazing. I mean, there was such a protest and a pushback. against them that they changed their mind and then they certified the results. Then this woman, Monica came out and said she wants to rescind her decision. She wants to change her mind and not certify the results. And then we're learning that she told the Washington Post that Trump called her, now ostensibly to thank her for all her hard work and maybe saying that, I'm sorry you're getting so many death threats because you certified the results. But the fact is, he's calling the jurors in a jury trial. He's calling the jurors and basically trying to rig the game. And that is, I mean, unprecedented is a word we've used a lot in the past 4 years. But this is almost, I mean, I see a lot of reference to the word coup, which is not COO, but COUP. And of course, I would always roll my eyes and say, oh, come on. But what he's doing, and he's basically trying to overturn the votes in so many key states. And basically, I wonder if it's part of a plan to somehow change the dynamic as we approach December 14th. And that is beyond frightening. It's troubling for democracy.
And Dr. Bloom, we should note that Republican Senator Lindsey Graham, who was reelected to his seat this year in South Carolina, is also being criticized for a situation that has been characterized differently depending on whether you're Senator Graham or the Republican Secretary of State in Georgia. But we are seeing high-level Republican officials like Lindsey Graham being accused of trying to influence the outcome or the review of the voting processes in the state. Your thoughts on that situation?
Well, I think we all... Well, I'll just speak for myself. I hoped more or thought better of Lindsey Graham. I hoped he would treat this election as he's treated past presidential elections. And I hope the same of many of the elected officials who are still holding out or still claiming that there's some sort of major event that's going to change the outcome. That said, it's unclear if Lindsey Graham himself will really have enough power to sway the results. Right now, we have seen the election officials, Republican and Democrat, in these different states hold pretty steady because their job at the end of the day is not to crown Trump president again, no matter what. Their job is just to provide an accurate count of votes, and this is what they do. This is their expertise. The other part of this that I think is interesting goes to the local officials and the local precinct captains and the people doing a lot of these recounts. And this is where I think elected officials like Lindsey Graham need to be careful, because it's not secretaries of state who are dealing with these precincts and these counts and the day-to-day operations. It's regular citizens who have devoted a lot of their time and energy to democracy. And it's one thing to criticize someone who's put themselves out there as a politician. It's another thing to start criticizing American citizens for trying to participate in the democratic process. And I don't think that's a good look, and I don't think that's a look that's going to hold up for much longer, or at least I'm crossing my fingers.
Can I jump in for a second? Because this is more than just the Lindsey Graham, whether he'll be successful or not. Basically, he's called the Secretary of State of Georgia and said, you should throw out the, he said, this is what Brad Raffensperger, the Secretary of State, said, that Lindsey Graham called him and said, get rid of legal votes because it went against the president. And Raffensperger said basically this was an intrusion not only by Lindsey Graham, but also now he's getting death threats because he said that the election was held fair and square. I mean, this is an intrusion into democratic processes that seems like there's some kind of violation of law. This is not a suggestion by Lindsey Graham. These are phone calls by Lindsey Graham, by Newt Gingrich, by Rudy Giuliani to election officials around the country, basically saying, doing what they can to overturn what we seem to think is the results of the November 3rd election. And that seems criminal.
It's a scare campaign.
The number is 513-419-7100. If you'd like to join Ken, Rachel, and me in this discussion, we're going to get to the trivia question in just a moment. Let's take a call from Kim. Hi, Kim. What's your question or comment?
Hi. Thank you for taking my call, and I want to make this really fast. Michael, these topics that you're talking about I think you're a little bit too big for 1 hour. My head is still reeling about P.G. Sittenfeld because I had a problem one time, and I'm like a penny compared to a dollar. And he was the only one that called me back to help me out with it. So I'm really, really sad. My question is, would you consider doing another show about him? Because these are just major, big topics that I don't think a half an hour will do justice to. And then as far as the president, this whole situation here, often a lot of us who are talking to one another are thinking, cool, especially when you're hearing about the drawdown in Iraq, and you start to wonder if he's buddying up with some of these or doing favors for someone and putting our national security at risk. Now, I don't want to say these things to accuse anybody, but I was wondering if there was anything to kind of slow the president down or keep him from doing, like, major things that can put our country at risk.
All right, Kim, we will address those deeper international questions on the other side of our upcoming break, but I want to let you know, Kim, first, thank you for your very thoughtful call. You are correct that the issues that we are learning about out of Cincinnati City Hall merit a lengthier, deeper conversation. We responded to breaking news as we could today. We are already rolling the wheels to put together a more in-depth program about what's going on. We'll have more about it on the News Review show tomorrow, and then we should have more on it throughout the week. Of course, you will hear news updates on 91.7 FM throughout the days to come and at WVXU.org. Kim, grateful for you listening, and thank you so much for your phone call. Before we get to the other question, Ken and Rachel, about the international consequences or if there's a way to slow the president down, I do want to get a reminder, Ken, what the trivia question is.
Who is the last member of the House from either Ohio or Kentucky to lose to a challenger in the November election?
All right. I believe Phil has an answer he'd like to offer. Hey, Phil, what's your answer?
I was going to say Steve Chabot.
Well, Steve Chabot did lose in 2006. That's a good guess, but he is not the most recent.
Good guess, Phil. And if you've got some time, feel free to try again. 513-419-7100. Let's go to Mike now. You've got an answer, Mike.
Yes, it's Ben Chandler in Kentucky.
Ben Chandler is the correct answer. 2012, he lost to Andy Barr, who still holds the seat. He's the last member of either Ohio or Kentucky delegation to lose to a challenger.
And the Chandler family, as you know, Ken Rudin, as a scholar of political history, is a legacy one in Kentucky.
That's right. His grandfather was happy, and the other members are Dopey, Sneezy, Bad Joe, and Doc.
Well done. Appreciate that. Hey, Mike, congratulations. You've got yourself a political junkie button. Our producer, Selena Reeder, will get on the line with you to get your information so that we can put that in the mail to you. Thank you for listening, and thank you for being a smart guy. We appreciate it. 513-419. Oh, and I hung up on Mike. Mike, please call back, and Selena Reeder will call you. We'll get your information. Mike, I'm so sorry. I hope you're still listening. Do please call back, and we'll get your information and get that coveted political junkie button to you. So sorry. I think I've done that twice over the past 2 years. I do apologize. We've got so much more to talk about, including what some are characterizing as a disastrous appearance in federal court by Rudy Giuliani, the personal attorney for President Trump. We continue with The Political Junkie on Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. And you've been listening to Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. The producer of today's show is Selena Reeder. The technical director is Josh Elstro. Our theme music is composed by Rob Fetters. You can find archives of our program online at WVXU.org. I'm Michael Monks, and this is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Michael Monks. We are joined by the political junkie, Ken Rudin. Hey, Ken.
Hi, Michael.
And again, Ken just gave us the correct answer to the political junkie trivia question. Ben Chandler, the caller was Mike. Mike, please call us back. I'm so sorry that I hung up on you. Selena Reeder, our producer, is standing by to get your information so that you can receive that coveted political junkie button in the mail. We're also happy to be joined today by University of Oklahoma Assistant Professor of Political Science at the Carl Albert Congressional Research and Studies Center, Dr. Rachel Bloom. Rachel, thank you for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
and join our conversation, especially if you're Mike, at 513-419-7100 and email talk at wvxu.org if you'd like to share some thoughts with us. We'll go back to the phones right away to get some questions from our listeners. John is on the line. Hi, John. What's your question?
Yes. I thought I had the trivia question, but I didn't. But anyway, I was kind of thinking how long it'll be before this big city con man, once he's out of office, he'll be on the sideline saying, oh, it's horrible. Oh, it's America. Oh, same old thing. And then as soon as he gets elected, the next week, everything's beautiful. So what's your guys' estimate on that before we got to go back and live in the woods again?
All right, John. I appreciate the call very much. Thank you for listening. Anybody want to respond to that?
I'm not exactly sure of the question. Was he talking about suggesting that Trump would be on the sidelines after January 20th? If he's saying that, I'm not sure if he said that, but if he is saying that, I disagree. I think Trump will be as visible, if not more visible than ever. And basically, the by saying that he's interested or may be interested in the 2024 running again, that freezes the Republican field and it continues to make the GOP the party of Donald Trump.
All right. Thank you for handling that, Ken. We appreciate it. We'll go to Teresa now. Hi, Teresa. This is Michael. What's your question or comment?
Hi, Michael. I really am struggling with this, and I want somebody that is smarter than me, like Dr. Bloom or Ken Rudin, to tell me how what the Republican Party is doing right now is not treason. And I mean that in a legal sense. How is what they're doing not treason?
Thank you for the call, Teresa. We'll send it over to Dr. Bloom for an answer on that. I mean, is the legal quest that the president and his team is seeking, I mean, are there treasonous implications?
I think it seems like that to a lot of us. And there have been many aspects of the Trump presidency that seemed to me that if they'd happened under any other president, that everyone would have been calling treason. So one of the things I have my students do when we're thinking about this and trying not to be partisan, we're just trying to analyze, is to say, well, if this were something that happened under the Obama administration, would we be just as mad, madder? You know, would it have been treason, not treason, or the Bush administration? And I think what Republicans are doing right now, if tables were turned and this were Democrats at any point, sorry about the dog, I think it would be treason.
Is the dog agreeing with you at this point? Is that what's happening?
Yes, the dog is very anti-treason. He's very upset.
Barbara Boxer.
Oh, how about that?
Yes.
We love a patriotic pup. All right, join our conversation, human or canine, 513-419-7100. That is the number to call. But I do want to talk about the legal case that the president is waging across the country. He's not doing well. They've got quite the losing record in their efforts to try to find a path to victory, as the president has referred to it on Twitter, for himself to be reelected, though he has lost the election. I want to note that Rudy Giuliani, the president's personal attorney, appeared in a federal courtroom in Pennsylvania before District Judge Matthew W. Brann. And I'm reading coverage of this, Ken, in the Washington Post, and it looks like Giuliani had not been in a federal courtroom in decades, and it kind of showed. I want to read a little bit of the coverage from the Washington Post about just some what appear to be basic understandings of proceedings in a federal courtroom scene. And how the former mayor of New York City and now personal attorney of President Trump did not fully understand what was taking place. So, quote, throughout the five-hour hearing in federal court in Williamsport, Pennsylvania, Giuliani, a former U.S. attorney and mayor of New York, came under heavy criticism from opposing counsel and appeared unable to answer several questions from Judge Brann about legal technicalities. Brann asked what standard of review he should apply in the case, and Giuliani replied, I think the normal one. Ken, how serious of a battle is the president waging when he sends an attorney into a federal courtroom who seems so ill-equipped for some of the basic methods that are expected to transpire there?
Yeah, I read that article too, and I was astounded to see how unprepared Giuliani sounded while he was in court. But basically, you know, I want to go a little bit more on what Teresa said. There's no basis for their challenges. It's one thing to say it was a close election and there may be some kind of fraud. There's no evidence of fraud at all. It's just saying that, well, our observers didn't get to look at the signatures. I mean, they're trying to come up with everything. And now they're no longer trying to challenge each voter. Now they're just trying to say they're trying to stall as much as they can, as I said. So then maybe perhaps the legislature, the Republican legislature in Pennsylvania, could form its own set of electors and send it. What I'm suddenly afraid of, and I hadn't thought about it until this week, you know, there's always been faithless electors in the past where members of the Electoral College, even though they should vote for the person who won that carried the state in the presidential election, these electors, for the most part, are allowed to vote there whoever they want to, which is kind of crazy, and it's a good argument for getting rid of the Electoral College. But what if, just as Donald Trump did with that voting person wherever state it was, and I guess it was in Michigan. Yeah, it was Michigan when basically he called her to basically, and she wanted to rescind her decision to certify the results. What if he calls all the electors and threatens them? I mean, look, I'm sounding like a paranoid here, but there could be a concerted effort on behalf of the administration to go after the actual electors and have them change their vote. And that frightens me. Look, there's no evidence, and nobody's ever suggested that's happening. But what they're doing is really trying to thwart the will of the people. It's one thing to lose an election. It's one thing to have the election disputed. It's not disputed. It's just that Donald Trump doesn't want to lose. Perhaps he fears what life would be like as a private citizen. But what they're doing, I don't know if Teresa is way off by talking about Teresa.
And let's go to some emails now. Brad from Wyoming, Ohio writes to us, Todd Portune must be rolling over in his grave at the corruption being unearthed on council, not to mention the national hoo-ha. Both parties need to push the reset button on ethical professional behavior. And of course, Todd Portune is the former Hamilton County Commissioner and Cincinnati City Councilman who died not that long ago. We still think about Todd Portune. He was a friend of the program. And we also have an email from Nancy, who writes, a big reason, I think, is that elections have become obscenely expensive. Why so much immoral behavior in politics? She's writing about candidates spend hours per day, week, raising money for their races. The way to change this is to change campaign financing laws, reduce the time and scope of elections, so normal people with normal campaigning can be elected to office. If not, it's hard to see how this will change unless only the wealthy self-pay for their runs for office. And Rachel, I want to let you know that I got a tweet from Kate, who says she wants to know the dog's opinion on P.G. Sittenfeld, the councilman who was arrested here in Cincinnati. Can you offer that perspective from us?
Well, the dog was so upset to hear about that he had to go outside and lay in the sun for a while. Okay. So he's doing that
lovely.
To kind of recuperate.
That sounds like a lovely way to spend a Thursday afternoon. But we're glad the rest of you are spending your Thursday afternoon with us here on Cincinnati Edition. We're going to continue momentarily. We've got more phone calls on the line to get to. And this is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Michael Monks. We are joined by the political junkie, Ken Rudin. Hey, Ken.
Hi, Michael.
And University of Oklahoma Assistant Professor of Political Science, Dr. Rachel Bloom, and her dog, unless that dog is still outside sunning. Thank you for being with us, Rachel.
Thanks for having me.
Let's get back to the phone lines now. They're pretty full. Let's check out Jeff. Hey, Jeff, what's your question or comment?
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I'm a listener and sustaining member.
Thank you.
What do you think is the likelihood of this scenario, that on the one hand, Biden goes ahead and becomes president, and Harris, of course, is vice president in January, as they should. But then Republicans take back control of the House and Senate in the election of 2022, and in 2023, they make Trump Speaker of the House, impeach and remove Biden and Harris, and install Trump anyhow. And I'll take the answer off.
Thank you, Jeff. We appreciate your patronage and your listenership and your questions. So, Ken, I'll let you tackle that one. The likelihood that a Republican-controlled Congress, again, which could happen after the 2022 election, and impeaching a President Biden.
Nothing surprises me. And first of all, you know, given the fact that the Republicans picked up a bunch of seats, far more than anybody expected in the 2020 elections, and given the fact that a new president usually loses seats of his party in the first midterm, there's no reason to doubt that the Republicans could very well recapture the House in 2022. And if they keep the Senate, look, why not? I mean, there are Republicans to this day who felt that the Trump impeachment thing was just a red herring and partisanship run amok. So there's no reason to suggest that Republicans can't say, well, you know, if you can impeach Trump, maybe we can impeach Biden. So, I mean, I can't believe we're talking head to head to 2023, but I do not rule that out at all.
In the 2022 Senate election, it is another heavy map for Republicans who have more seats up for election 21.
But very few vulnerable states.
Right,
They're all in Republican states.
We should note that Ohio, Kentucky, and Indiana, Republican incumbents in all three, will be up for re-election in 2022 as well. But let's not get ahead of ourselves too much. It's one day at a time, folks. Let's go back to the phones. We have Handy on the line. Hi, Handy. What's your question or comment?
Hi, this is Handy. I'm usually come to Cincinnati quite a lot, and I follow the politics here a lot. But this is a question from someone from overseas. Is gerrymandering legal?
Okay, thank you, Handy. We will take your question offline and let our panelists answer that question. Dr. Bloom, you can help us with this. Gerrymandering.
Yes.
It's handled differently, you know, depending on, I guess, the states that you might have a commission or might have the legislature draw these up. But yes, I mean, technically, it does sound like it's legal unless it does in some states appear to be too favorable to one party or the other, right?
Yeah, so this is something where there are a few clear rules, and then beyond that, there's a lot of interpretation, and it's been a big issue in the courts recently. The rules on it, or the legal part of this, is the state legislatures do have the power to redraw district lines based on a census. The Supreme Court has ruled on this a couple of times. One of their most notable decisions was in Baker versus Carr, and that's when they said a district has to be geographically contiguous. In other words, you can't just have a district that's divided by another district. All parts of a district have to be touching. But that doesn't really give us much else. So what we've seen a lot of in the last 10 years or so is something called cracking and packing. So breaking up districts, just like Hamilton County. So breaking up a blue county into two red districts, one and two. That is technically legal, but it's starting to face more and more challenges in courts. And so states like Pennsylvania have been taking a look at other ways to draw districts. So the answer is kind of complicated. Gerrymandering itself, as long as the districts are touching, is allowed. But more and more people are starting to ask whether we really want districts that are drawn just to create a specific partisan map.
51341.
And racial redistricting is against the law. The Supreme Court
yes.
has ruled that, you know, redrawing a district on depending on race is illegal. But partisan redistricting has not been ruled out by the court.
Let's go to Tom now. Hi, Tom. What's your question or comment?
Yeah, hi. Good to talk to you.
Likewise.
My wife and I live in one of the northern Kentucky counties. It's a small county. I'm not going to name it, but we volunteered for the to be poll workers this time because they put out the call, and a lot of the people, as you know, are very elderly, and we're not young, but we were the babies. Anyway, we put a whole day in. We got there at 5 in the morning, left at 7 at night. It's a very, very red county, and I watched many, many people pull the lever, you know, for the Republican Party. I'm not a member of that or a supporter. But when children that were old enough to understand came with their parents, I said, you know, watch this. Something very important is happening here, which I truly believe. And I just find that this behavior is so insulting. Everybody I worked with, our county clerk, worked their tails off to make sure that it was an honest and fair election.
And I'm not thrilled with the way my county voted. But on the other hand, that was the vote. That's what the majority wanted. That's what this is supposed to be about. And it's just a travesty what this person's pulling now. Should anybody be surprised at what he's trying to pull? You have to live under a rock not to be surprised by anything this man does.
Tom, thank you so much for,
thanks for the call. Thanks for letting me ring.
Absolutely. We appreciate the call, and thank you for volunteering at the polls. It's an important gig. We do appreciate it. Let's go now to Risha. Hi, Risha. This is Michael. What's your question or comment?
Hi, Robin. Hi, Ken. How are you? Oh, Michael, sorry.
That's okay.
I'm calling with a question for Ken, but actually he touched on it already, which is faithless electors. I've actually been worried about this for a while, and as the day in December gets closer, my question is, what happens if President Trump and some of his, lawyers or other Republicans or potential influencers do change the minds of electors and they actually do cast their ballots differently than they promised? Isn't it then too late to question how they were influenced? Isn't that then the election right there, and there's nothing we can do at that point?
Thanks for the call, Risha. We appreciate it. Ken, did you want to touch on that again?
Boy, that's a great question, and I think about it a lot. You know, I mean, when you think of the 2000 election, you need 270 electoral votes to become president. George W. Bush got 271. So had some Bush electors switched to Gore, Gore would have been president. And as we know, it's not the vote on, as Risha accurately says, it's not the vote on election day that really makes who decides the next president. It's the Electoral College vote on December 14th. That frightens me. I didn't think of that until recently. Look, Trump just got rid of Chris Krebs, was the head of Homeland Security voting election funding and security. And he said the election was held fairly and honestly, and Trump fired him because that goes against what Trump thought. So let's just be aware of that. But my goodness, if there's some kind of chicanery with the Electoral College come December 14th, my goodness, I don't know what would happen if the election were turned on that.
We are just about out of time, but let's get Mike on. Mike, we've got about 15 seconds for your question.
Okay, thank you. I heard that Lindsey Graham said if the Republican Party doesn't change the American electoral process, there will never be another Republican elected president again. I'm curious as to what he was contemplating doing. How did he want to change it? Does anybody know what that is?
Thank you for the call, Mike. We appreciate that. I'll throw that over to Dr. Bloom. This is a concern, apparently, for Republicans. Was that a reference to maybe seeing a trend in Texas? And once losing that electoral vote, you add up California, Texas, and New York that are reliably Democratic, and it becomes a challenging electoral map for the GOP.
That is very true. We have changing demographics, and we know that young people are increasingly trending Democrat. And then the Electoral College has always been a tricky thing. I mean, this goes all the way back to the Constitutional Convention, the debate about small states versus big states, whether every person counts. It's a debate we've never really resolved in this country. And at least in contemporary times, a lot of the push against changing how the Electoral College works or even adding places like DC to the state map, a lot of those pushes not to do these things have come from Republicans because that would...
Right. Rachel, we got to end it there. Rachel, yeah. Ken, thank you. An email from Tony says to thank you as well. So thank you for listening.